Hey guys, Jason Seitz here, your resident paramedic, firefighter, nurse on the Back to Basics podcast. I'm here along with my brother, Christopher Seitz, a ER physician, and our job on this podcast is to take complicated medical topics and break them down back to basics. But this week, you're tuning in for a very special crossover episode in which Chris and I will be guest appearing on the crossover event of the century, bigger than the Avengers Infinity War. It's going to be EMS 2020 and Back to Basics coming together to review a case. So if you're not familiar with EMS 2020, they contribute a lot of our content on Guardian CME. They are great friends and colleagues of ours, Chris Finkstein and Spencer Oliver. They're both flight paramedics. What they do is they take submitted cases on their podcast and they review them. And sometimes they have some guest stars along. So this time it'll be Chris and I. So check it out. As always, go to guardiancme.com if you'd like a credit for this. You can check that out there. And we hope to see you next time for another more traditional Back to Basics episode. But in the meantime, stay tuned. We got lots coming for you. Stay sweet.
This podcast is hosted by Chris Finkston and Spencer Oliver. They are both experienced paramedics. They've done everything from 911 ground ambulance to volunteer fire department work and are both currently flight paramedics. This podcast reviews scenarios based on real calls run by real out-of-hospital clinicians. Details are changed to protect the privacy of those involved and to present educational opportunities to the listener. This podcast is EMS 2020.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of EMS 2020, and this is the crossover event of the year. Probably, I don't know, 2 to 3 times bigger than when the Family Guy and Simpsons episode crossover event happened, if you guys remember that. Our shadow is just over the top of that, because today we have the host from the Back to Basics podcast, and you guys have probably heard us talk, I don't know, maybe once to 1 million times about Guardian CME, where you can go get free continuing education, which everybody needs if you want to, you know, keep your job. And if you like our content, it's on there. You go get free CEs. There's also other content by these guys with the Back to Basics podcast. And please welcome Jason and Chris Seitz. One's a doctor, one's a firefighter. We're not going to tell you who until the end of the episode. You have to guess who.
We'll never know. No, actually, so I was thinking about this. To me, this crossover, it's like, do you remember when you were a kid and like all of a sudden Batman and Robin were fighting with the Ninja Turtles?
Yeah, right? That was good stuff.
And I'll leave it up to the viewer to figure out which one of us is Batman.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. I like that.
I just put a black hood on all of a sudden.
He not trying to influence the vote, but he does the rest of this podcast and swear to me.
No, well, thank you. We appreciate you guys having us on. It's always a pleasure. And yeah, we've got our Back to Basics podcast and your guys' podcast on Guardian CME for free CAPSI credits. So yeah, Definitely check that out, guardiancme.com. But yeah, thanks for having us, guys.
Oh, no, we're just glad you guys continue to associate yourselves with us. So that's great.
It's true.
One of the best things about Guardian CME, just to keep pushing that, because it is great, is that it's not like, there's a lot of things like, oh, it's free CE, but then you get like 2 credits and then you got to pay more. That's not what this is. Everything is free. All you gotta do is log in, also free, and have a good time. So with that, I'll get kind of our other housekeeping out of the way. Each and every episode, including this episode, will get its own post on our social media. We are on Facebook at EMS20/20, and you can find us on Instagram at EMS2020Show. If you would like your call to be featured on EMS2020, don't send an email to EMS2020podcast@gmail.com, because we have a new form that you can fill out. It is also available through links in our social media. It's really easy to find with a pinned post on our Facebook. And if you go to our beacons page, which are linked in our bio on the Instagram, you can find the form there. Many of you have found the form, and we really appreciate you guys using that form. That has made things so much easier for us. So we really appreciate you guys doing that. Let's see what else. Oh, with that, please check out our YouTube channel, Rapid Sequence Information. We recently put out an episode. It's one of our better ones about what may or may not have happened to Damar Hamlin. We talk a little bit about commotio cordis and what causes that, as well as we talk about what we think may have been ignored, is the fact that we had some EMTs on that field under immense amounts of pressure who still did the right thing and actually pulled off a really good code. And it sounds like DeMar Hamlin is doing much better. And that is in no small part to both the athletic trainer that's on the field who started CPR and the EMS responders who were on the field that took it from there. So with that, let's briefly introduce you guys as well. For anyone that doesn't know you guys, Chris Seitz, you are a doctor, right? Like a real one.
And so they say that they're letting me keep those credentials for now. We'll see.
As they recently proved, God, where was that? I want to say it was Louisiana. There was a paramedic who was faking himself as a doctor recently. Yeah.
So the message is that really like anyone can be a doctor. And also, what is a doctor really? I don't know. Supposedly. So I'm a board certified emergency physician. I also am the CEO and chief medical officer for Guardian. And that includes not only our educational content, but also Guardian Medical Direction. We do a lot of medical oversight across the country.
Way cool.
So yeah, I still work some shifts clinically.
Well, yeah. All right. So that was George Santos Seitz. And now let's talk to Jason.
And I'm Batman. So I'm Jason. I'm a firefighter, paramedic, and a nurse. So I run education full time at our business, but work as a nurse on the side, and I have about 10 years of experience as a firefighter medic. So
awesome. So we have everything covered. Yeah. We have firefighter medic, we have transport medics, we have an ER physician. This is fantastic. So Spence, please hurry up and go. I don't know why you've been waiting and not just starting the episode.
Yeah, I don't know either. Yeah. All right. Well, so in this episode, we are going to talk about cardiogenic shock, bradycardia, and then pacing or pressor treatments. So prepare your bodies, because here we go.
Bodies prepared.
Welcome to another amazing episode of Hex Kitchen, back to the EMS 2020 edition.
Hex Kitchen.
Yeah.
Now you decide to censor out of all the things we've said. I'm sorry. Out of all the shit we've said in the past, now you want to censor the word heck. Okay.
It's really more that I don't want Gordon Ramsay scares me and I don't want him suing us. So here we go. Sure. This week, a medic from the red kitchen and one from the blue kitchen will have to work together to win the surprise patient challenge. But with each kitchen cooking up different treatment ideas, will this end up a recipe for disaster? Guest judge and master doctor Chris Ram Seitz and RN medic firefighter Jason Wolfgang Seitz will ultimately have to decide who advances and who will leave Hex Kitchen forever.
I watched the hell out of this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, dude, totally.
Don't we have to burn your picture when you lose at the end? Isn't that how that show goes?
That's definitely it. Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm expecting some flame. Yeah. All right. In the red kitchen, we have Chef Red. Chef Red has been a paramedic for 2 years at the time of this call, with several years as an EMT prior. Fun fact, they were in the military and worked as part of a search and rescue group. Cool. And they got to work on the helicopters that have all the space for activities, unlike civilian EMS helicopters, where if you want to start an IV, you have to like borrow your patient's leg or your partner's leg to open up stuff.
Yeah, it's a very intimate affair. So were they flying like the 60s?
It was huge. That's all I know. They're like, you can get up and walk around. And I'm like, wow, you could get up.
Wow.
Interesting.
I did some flight medicine as a resident. And I remember like they would put me in like the co-pilot seat. This is the only spot for you, right? Yeah. This is the only like potentially open spot. But the most interesting thing, like when you first start, you don't realize how small these things are. And I get in, I'm so excited. And we fly there, we get the patient in, I get back in, and I feel like the patient's face is like breathing in my ear. It's like that close. I'm like, oh, wow, this is a little more cramped than I thought. You know?
Doc, am I going to be okay?
All right. So working with Chef Red is the medic from the blue kitchen. Chef Blue is a multi-decade paramedic who helps train new medic and oversees operations in their EMS area. So speaking of their EMS area, let's talk about it. Welcome to Hex Kitchen EMS Service. This third service EMS agency with less than 10 ambulances plus stations serving their county's guests in a 450 square mile area with a nice mix of rural, urban, and suburban patches. Each ambulance can serve ALS treatments with a typical crew combination of medic basic or medic medic on each unit. There are several sous chefs in this kitchen called captains who can travel around ensuring the quality of care. And each station also has a lead chef on as well as lead medics on every shift at each station.
All right. So in non-kitchen terms, are there chase cars going on? Like what's kind of going? Like,
yeah, they essentially they have like BCs that or battalion chiefs that kind of cruise around.
Gotcha.
And then they have, you know, lieutenants on each at each station.
Gotcha.
Or and so lead chefs don't ruin it, man.
Gotcha. I was understanding the analogy better than I am now that you made it realistic.
Yeah. Now it's just it's kind of like the you know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Perfect. All right. Well, in Hex Kitchen, each shift serves patients during the hours of breakfast, brunch, lunch, late lunch, old people dinner time, regular people's dinner time, late night munchies time, and early hours of old person breakfast time. So that's 24 hours of coverage.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah. The crews can deliver to the Denizens of Hex Kitchen to several Denizens? Hospitality hospital Denizens.
Yeah. I thought it was Denizens.
Denizens?
Yeah.
That might be it.
Oh, yeah. Ask the doctor. Doctor, what do you think?
Yeah.
Doctor of grammar.
Yeah.
Denizens.
I concur.
Okay.
Perfect.
I concur. Why didn't I concur? Denizens of Hex Kitchen to several hospitality hospitals. Hospital choice isn't an issue for this episode, as the hospital the patient is taken to does all the things. There are several support agencies which do have like paid and volunteer firefighting, and they can assist in cooking up BLS level treatments when needed.
Don't jump off the analogy and then go back to cooking up.
Yeah, you're throwing me for a loop.
Like the hospitals are
like, all I know is that
hospitality hospitals.
Oh, like, yeah. Good.
Gotcha.
Hospitality hospitals. Don't worry, I had you. Yeah, and then there's BLS fire agencies that can respond to calls. So here we go. It's been quite a shift in Hex Kitchen so far. It's a bright and sunny day. Blue and Red have been working together and have run several warm-up calls already, preparing for the upcoming patient challenge. Red Chef will be taking the lead on the next call that comes in. It's 14:57, and dispatch announces it's once again time to open Hex Kitchen for a Delta level unconscious/fainting patient.
Okay.
A BLS fire service is dispatched to respond as well to assist. As Red and Blue respond, additional details are added to the ticket. This is a witness syncopal episode of a 75-year-old male who is now awake, pale, and diaphoretic.
Okay.
Blue Chef is driving code 5. That's lights and sirens with the unnecessary addition of high speeds.
Okay. Actually, really quick, can I cut you off and just talk about Delta response really quick for people who may not know?
I mean, you were going to anyway, so go ahead.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, perfect. So really quick, it's Delta response. If you guys listen to our show, you probably heard us talk about this before, or you may have it in your system. Delta response is a part of a system where the response is tiered, and there's usually a alpha through Delta. And depending on where you're at, this is going to be customized for the area. That determines the resources that are going to be sent. And so an alpha response is usually like a BLS transfer, something very low acuity, and then as you get closer to Delta, it ramps up from there. These systems are great in areas where you may not have where it's not necessarily a paramedic saturated area. And so you can't afford to just send every resource to every call every time. And so this way you're sending resources that are more closely matched to what's needed. The plus side is you have paramedics that are or ALS and more resources available for calls that actually need it. The downside is, of course, with this, every now and again, you're getting a mistriage and less resources are going to show up that are needed. So there's plus and minuses to it. But in this case, it's a Delta response. So I'm guessing all the things are going.
All the things are going. Yep.
Okay. Perfect.
So as Red Chef reads through the notes, they advise Blue, "Hey, this sounds like the real deal. Remember your training." Blue laughs. Red is considering the big killers for this patient: arrhythmias, strokes, STEMIs.
Okay.
Based on these call details. All right. So they arrive first to the patient's residence 4 minutes later. It's a suburban setting, and the patient is located in a single-story ranch-style home. Red and Blue exit their ambulance and grab their monitor and kit. The kit contains IVIO stuff, bandaging stuff, ALS and BLS medications, trauma, airway equipment, and oxygen bottle attachments. In this kitchen, fire will bring in the stretcher from the ambulance, which is where the O2 bottle will make its, make its appearance as well as it's secured to the stretcher. Yep. I know. I know. I giggle now because I have to ask every time. And
I'll tell you. So here's the thing is, if you have two oxygen bottles and one's in the stretcher, I don't care. That's fine. But please have an oxygen bottle with a regulator, mind you, in the kit that you bring in, because you can't always get the stretcher to where you need to go. But the kit, you can.
And I disagree. You don't need the regulator. You could just open it at the patient's face. You probably actually get air. Just
stick it right in the mouth. You know, that'll do it.
It's so cold.
Please don't do that. Don't do that.
All right. As Blue and Red make their way inside, they are met by the patient's wife. The wife tells the crew that the patient just got back from a 25-mile bike ride, walked in the door, and then collapsed. The patient was reported to be unconscious for about 1 to 2 minutes before waking up and reporting that they're having severe chest pain. They then crawled into a chair. The crew follow the spouse to the bedroom where the patient is located, and here's their doorway assessment. This is a 75-year-old male, 5'8" or 172 centimeters, weighing approximately 165 pounds, and I didn't do the kilograms on that. Hold on. God damn it.
Can't you do it in your head, Flymatic?
Yeah.
I don't do that kind of stuff in my head. I don't do math in my head. That's danger zone.
Highway to... It's a 75 kilos.
Yeah. 75 kilos.
I did that in my head.
I didn't.
Yeah.
I did.
What were you looking down for?
I'm writing on my whiteboard. That's all.
You were counting your fingers. That's seven...
Yeah. Have an abacus under the desk.
So, according to Red Chef, the patient would look like a healthy, active 75-year-old guy if he weren't so pale and diaphoretic. The patient is sitting slouched in the chair with their eyes closed. They are noted to be breathing normally, and there is evidence of urinary incontinence. From the doorway, there does not appear to be any evidence of trauma. So, all right, let's pause here. What are your concerns, treatment assessment priorities for this patient? We'll start in order. Chris.
Which one?
Crispy.
Crispy. All right. So anytime you have a syncopal patient, I do like how they were pre-gaming and they were talking about like what could cause that. Here's my opinion on syncope. Almost anything can cause it. There's just such a large number of things that can cause somebody to pass out or lose consciousness that you really need to treat these like any other altered LOC and start working on your AIOU tips criteria, or as I like to do on this show, the, you know, does it have fuel, et cetera, et cetera. And so for me, the big concerns is going to be figuring out why he passed out in the first place. One thing I said, they said no evidence of trauma, like from the doorway. I'm not sure what trauma you can assess, like from the doorway. Like, you know what I mean? Like no evidence of trauma, like, there's no dents in the ground. Like, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm going to get there.
I mean, he looks uninjured aside from the fact that he's pale, diaphoretic, and you know, like, but there's no obvious,
gotcha. You know, he's not bleeding. So
yeah, it's not bleeding. There's no deformities.
So with any altered LOC, especially when we or any syncopal episode, I'm going to go straight to the basics. I'm going to start with ABCs. I want to know how his airway is, how he's breathing, and what his circulation looks like. So what's his heart rate? What's his blood pressure? What's he look like on the monitor? And then from there, we're going to get things like, you know, CBG. I like to throw in a stroke assessment at one point, usually on these as well, but that's maybe not be a priority if he's not exhibiting any outward stroke symptoms right up front, but probably should be done before he gets to the ER. And that's where I would start. Those are my priorities.
All right. Jason Wolfgang Seitz, what are your thoughts?
I don't want to get pee on me. So
I failed right off the bat. That's experience right there, people.
I think 25-mile bike ride.
Yeah.
like I'm making an assumption here, is probably a pretty healthy looking guy, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's diaphoretic. We don't know if that's because there's some sort of issue going on or if he just maybe like 25 miles. So he's diaphoretic. Right.
Yeah, but I'm
like when it came to, is he altered? I missed that part. Are we not?
He is sitting slouched with his eyes closed. Okay. This is sort of that doorway assessment.
Yeah. So after the ABCs, I'd be concentrating on like mental status. Like where are we at with mental status? Because if he is altered, there's a lot of things it could be. And like Chris said, we could do a Cincinnati, things like that to try to rule out stroke. But I'd be thinking things like you just biked 25 miles, you're diaphoretic, you peed yourself. Is this a sugar issue? Is this a seizure? You know, this
right.
So, the incontinence is actually pretty telling, which is,
he was out. He was out. Like, biking 25
miles. Or he just doesn't give a That's a possibility too.
Could be drunk, you know. I'm just surprised that biking 25 miles makes you guys sweaty. That's crazy. That doesn't make me sweat at all.
He's home from the bar. That explains the incontinence and the passing out in the doorway. But
it's a true fact. The bike doesn't have one of those breathalyzer things to use it. So
the kickstand stays down until you breathe in, then it pops up.
Did wife witness the syncope at the door, correct?
Yeah.
How convenient, by the way. You made it all the way there and then passed out in the doorway. Perfect.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, I think that goes along with the whole there's no evidence of trauma. Like, wife would know if he conked his head. So
true. Yeah. All right. Dr. Ramsites.
Yeah, so I look at it a little bit differently as a doctor, I think, because like I'm thinking here, all right, I need four nurses, a really nice room. I need more room. I need more room. I need four nurses. I need someone who's going to touch this guy. I mean, I'm just like that. My priority
is different. A raise, a good night's sleep.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I agree with everything everybody else is saying here with the, what's actually also very concerning to me is the chest pain. Like she said, he's having chest pain.
Right.
Like that's not normal. Right. I mean, when I say normal for syncope, you know what I mean? Like, plenty of people pass out for lots and lots of different reasons. Obviously our job is to rule out the most worrisome. The fact that he's like almost newly symptomatic after is a big concern to me, right? So I want to get him on the monitor right away and obviously check all those things and get that EKG fast, just because like that doesn't fit as, I mean, it could, but I'm just saying, like I said, that would be a big red flag for me. It'd be symptomatic. It's what, you know, like some people get symptomatic before and then pass out. It almost sounds like he like passed out and then got symptomatic, which is just different, you know?
Yeah.
Different. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, continuing on, Red Chef goes over to the patient to start an assessment. So level of consciousness, GCS is documented as 14. They're saying that the eyes just open to verbal, but the patient follows all commands and responds appropriately. The patient is alert and oriented, though, again, like they described, somewhat slow to respond, just sort of delayed in their response. There is equally weak bilateral movements in all extremities. The patient's airway is patent. They report normal respirations at this time, and lung sounds are auscultated and reported to be clear, and there is no radial pulse present. The fire department shows up. He is sitting. Yes.
Okay. He's still upright then. Okay.
Yep. The fire department shows up and they're assigned to get vitals and a blood pressure while Red places the patient on the monitor. So I'm going to jump into the history of present illness while fire is setting all that up. And here's what we have from the patient and the wife. The patient normally does a 15 to 20, a 20 mile bike ride, but today decided to do a 25er. They deny having any issues during the ride and they remember the whole event. They remember getting home and then just remember waking up on the floor, reporting 6 out of 10 crushing substernal chest pain. They deny any shortness of breath, nausea. And per the wife, the patient does have a history of seizures, but they didn't witness any seizure activity with this collapse.
Oh, this sucks.
Yeah.
Guys.
Everything is still a possibility.
For past medical history, The patient has a seizure disorder for which the patient takes Lamictal. And wife isn't sure what the disorder is exactly because the patient hasn't had a seizure in a long time. Okay. So they're just like, I don't know what these seizures are, because they did try and suss out like, hey, does he respond with seizures, or is it, you know, full body tonic clonic movements? And for allergies, the patient is allergic to penicillin. All right. So Red Chef is trying to wipe down the patient with a towel because the electrodes are refusing to stick, because to this day, we still haven't invented electrodes that'll stick to diaphoretic skin.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. And they hear the fire department inflate the cuff. And they just tell the crew like, yeah, hey, you know what? That's all I need to know, because this further confirms that the patient is incredibly hypotensive. They do get the four lead, and this is the rhythm that they see on the monitor. Let me pull up my screenshot of that here. Is it this one? Yeah. All right.
So while you're doing that, like, I'll just say, I don't know, but like, for me, not having any having no symptoms before a syncopal event increases my suspicion tremendously that something more serious is going on, right? Like, if you tell me like, oh, I wasn't really feeling well, I was kind of nauseous, I got kind of dizzy, and then I passed out, I'm a little more assured than if you told me like I was perfectly fine and just collapsed, right? Like that is right. More worrisome to me in a lot of ways. So
we're working out, so we know our body's under stress, but this workout is fairly regular for this patient. My big thing is like, we said we had left sided weakness or right sided.
No. He has weakness on all sides. He's just weak in general.
Bilateral weakness. Okay. Cause
bilateral weakness.
We're not running like a stroke severity scale at this point. Like,
no.
So I'm looking at
that EKG. Do you want opinions now, or do you want me to hold off?
No, go ahead. Give your opinions on what you're seeing.
It sucks. If we look at the middle one here, I don't know what lead that is, but to me, you have a really clear, what I would call a complete heart block. Cause take a look at those P waves. Those P waves are all marching in rhyme with each other. The only time you can't really see it is when there's a big old, T wave right there with that depression right afterwards. And then you have the QRS is kind of on their own beat. It's bradycardic. You've got some pretty clear depression, or what you call, I guess, like bowler's hat sign, Spence, up there. And then you've got elevation. Looks like elevation down here in the lower one. Bowler's hat sign, by the way, is not a real thing. It's something we made up on an episode. So that's just kind of that's for the people who listen more common. So
because in this top lead, I don't think that you would recognize a block because everything looks so regular and you can't. I would say too, like, another thing I would just point out is that, like, he's hypotensive, he's diaphoretic, and like, we're seeing like ST disruption. That could be, that doesn't necessarily, we'll see where the case goes. That doesn't necessarily mean he's having a heart attack. He could just be having ischemia from poor perfusion. I mean, like, there's so, like, right. So you can see it. I think sometimes people think like ST elevation, it's an MI across the board. Mm-hmm. No, it's a sign of ischemia, right?
Yeah.
So, right. Severe hypotension and bradycardia can cause ischemia itself. So just something to point out, I think.
No, that's a good, that's a brilliant observation.
I think one of the things here that would lead me away from like a third degree heart block, and this is sort of like, it doesn't matter in this situation if it's a third degree, second degree, in that it's slow and that's really all we care about. This is something that you kind of, I think you look at after, but this to me looks more like a second degree type two, just because of the PR interval in the one lead we have is it's regular here before that QRS.
And it is long. That's true. I think the hard part about this one, about whether you're going to call it a second degree type two or a complete heart block, is that you don't have enough info between the QRS comp. You know what I mean? Like, normally you're able to see you're able to see a few more examples before you drop a beat. But if it is a high degree Mobitz, then you have, or a secondary type two, then you're dropping every other beat, and that kind of makes it difficult. But like you said, at the end of the day, it's a high, as far as EMS is concerned, it's a high degree heart block.
Right. Well, I'll be honest with you too. Even like, I'll go as far as say, like, even as far as cardiology is concerned, right? Like I could see myself sitting in an ER, and me and the cardiologist could debate this all day too. They're symptomatically in a block. Like the symptom part of it trumps the rest, right? The fact that they're
100%
doesn't really matter anymore. Cause I think sometimes people see, and Jason and I have talked about this even on our podcast, but like people think that like these types of like, even like this one, like has a diagnosis to it. Like you would be surprised how many times I'm like, man, I'm not really sure. Let me ask the cardiology. And they're like, I mean, it could be this or this. And let's even like, I think sometimes people think that like interpreting EKGs, like you either can or you cannot. Right. And like, it's an art that like no one has truly, I mean, like I've disagreed with cardiologists. I've had multiple cardiologists disagree with one another. To your point, at the end of the day, symptomatic, there's a block.
Well, they're bradycardic, right? Like that's the problem. Like Spencer said, like it's not really about having a block. Anything we do in the field isn't fixing the block. We're fixing the subsequent bradycardia from the block, right?
Yeah.
What's mistaken for a third degree is a first degree or a second degree type one, because ever elongating PR interval looks like it might
be
associated with the, so what I try to look for all the time is warped QRSs. Cause you want to try to find a P wave that's landing on a QRS and then it makes the QRS look funny.
So nice.
And you can kind of see that in this, some of the QRS complexes look a little bit different in that second one. So that's where you can kind of tell that the P waves might be marching through.
Gotcha.
Oh, gotcha.
This is just to kind of solidify this point, not to delve on too much. In the teenage heartbreak episode, one of our recent episodes, I may or may not have gone on a lengthy rant about there's not a lot of point in sitting on scene trying to diagnose exactly what it is. Right. And in that particular episode, there were two hospitals, it was severe enough to where it was obviously going to be a licensed sirens response. There were two hospitals close by. One can't help the patient if it is a STEMI. The other one absolutely can. And I'm like, well, we know we're going to that hospital because there's no way you're going to roll into a hospital that's, an inch taller than a critical access hospital with this. So,
well, and to Jason's point too, it doesn't even matter if there's a block. It's bradycardic and symptomatic. Well, Up until we've stabilized the patient in the ER, I'm not diving in to try to figure out more on a CKG. I just think that would be detrimental to the patient.
This is one of those pitfalls from paramedic education, at least in some of the programs that I've been a part of, where you must identify what this rhythm is.
Right.
And it's not about the rhythm necessarily. It's really just recognizing that, hey, this is too slow. And so this is where people can get into trouble, where they're like, I need to figure out what this is before I can proceed. That would be the mistake.
And this is fitting for our theme of this episode, but I hate the comments about cookbook medics all the time, because what happens is people say, don't be a cookbook medic. You need to know all the background. Like you need to be able to make the recipe your own way kind of thing. And it's like, yeah, you know what? Like what turns into bad cooks, people that don't start with a cookbook, right? If you started as and you understand the education behind this. If I had one of my guys come to me and show me this and go, what do you think? Do you think it's a this or do you think it's a that? I would picture myself coming to Dr. Seitz and saying, what do you think of this? And him telling me, this is an unstable bradycardia. That's all that matters, right? It doesn't
really,
like, you got to know what's behind that. And that's where it like drives me crazy when people are like, you got to know all the nuances of EKGs, not just the algorithms. No, yes, start with the algorithms, because that's what we do. Like, we're supposed to call them in the ER and let them think kind of more of the complicated stuff and move down the line. But initially, like, our job is stabilization and resuscitation. And this is an unstable patient. So what are we going to do for them? It doesn't matter if they're bradycardic because they're hypotensive, if they're bradycardic because their heart's janked, if they're bradycardic because they got struck by lightning. Like, I'm treating bradycardia the same way, you know?
Well, to that point, I love it too. When like, even in the ER, like we as ER doctors are like trying to like calculate out what like push dose pressures. And like meantime, someone's like in the corner doing like one-handed CPR. Like it's like you're not doing even the bare minimum, really.
Yeah. So
who cares if it's, I don't know.
I think when people say don't be a cookbook medic, the way I interpret that, I think it's the way you're probably interpreting it too, is just to understand that we have algorithms and things to follow. Sometimes patients will not fit into the algorithm and you might have to think outside the algorithm. That to me is what, you don't have to be bound to it, but it's one of those things where it's like, if you're going to vary from that algorithm, you need to be able to tell me that you at least went down it before you do to hop off.
Well, right. Yeah, and yeah. it's the just because there's such thing as gray doesn't mean we shouldn't recognize white as white and black is black. Right.
Right.
Like when something is that obvious, like get to the point with it. Right. And I think what happens is in our egos, especially in pre-hospital medicine, in our egos,
yeah,
we start being like, well, this could be Brugada's. So we really need to think about, you know, and we're tightening our
I love that.
Utility belt thing. And we're, you know, button up our freaking polo and we got our cargo pants on because we were at the IC conference recently.
We take our trauma shears out of the holster. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And our bandolier of
Chewbacca.
Yeah. You know, we're ready to go. I totally want a bandolier of just syringes.
Yeah. So we all agree prophylactic defibrillation, moving on.
Wonderful. All right. Yep. Good. I'm glad we got a doctor on board with that. Let's go forward. All right. Wait.
just say, yeah, we're good.
I concur. I changed my mind.
Fold the cheese. All right. So Blue Chef, on seeing this rhythm, immediately gets out their IV kit and starts an 18 gauge IV in the left AC as Red puts on the auto cuff and the 12 lead. The regular blood pressure cuff that the fire department was trying to use is instead used to start infusing saline into the patient. Red Chef calls this a third degree AV block with an underlying infarct pattern. And this is the 12 lead. I'll once again share my screen here.
Okay. Well, that's gross. Okay. So let's take a look at this. So we'll start with this right down here. So I don't see, there's not really a QRS in 1, 2, or 3 to really look at until you get to the very end. It's kind of hard to see where the lead division is on this EKG. But I would say, I believe this, oh, there's lead division right there. I found it. Okay. If anyone else is having trouble, it's right along here. So to me, it looks like there may be depression here in 1. If I'm going with the isoelectric line here, may have a few boxes of depression. Head on down to 2, may have a box of elevation there. If we're going with the PR interval as our isoelectric, down in 3, I think we have a lot of elevation again. So that's 2, 3. And I'm going to just jump over to AVF just to see if there's a spoiler alert. And there is. So it looks like we have elevation in 2, 3 in AVF. ABR, ABL, ABL's got some depression there. Moving on to these leads, we've got depression in, looks like V2, V3, and these leads over here look meh, fine. V1, kind of too close to tell on here. So I'd be worried about a inferior MI on this guy with possible right side ventricular involvement.
All right. Does everybody concur?
Sure. I wouldn't go that far even yet. Because I don't know, like, if his symptomatic bradycardia is just causing ischemia, I would have, yes, it's causing ischemia to the inferior region. You know what I mean? Like, the regionality is correct.
Sure.
But again, like, until I get this guy sped up, like, that could all resolve once we get, you know what I mean? So,
true.
This fits the criteria for a STEMI alert, but because of the background, we would want to treat the unstable bradycardia first.
Absolutely.
That's all.
Yeah. All right. So,
yeah. So I think that's kind of a good point there is, and this is one of the things that I really like about EMS, and truly the only reason I didn't become a doctor, because obviously I could.
It's not that hard.
Yeah. Nice.
There's a paramedic doing it right now. Don't
see. Yeah. Exactly. Joy, he's no longer doing it. But
what's impressive is how long he did it for. That is nuts.
Yeah. But when it comes down to it, the cool thing about it is, you know, what we're looking for is, you know, like Jason just said, is this a STEMI? Maybe not. Maybe, like you said, it could be causing ischemia to that area, and that's what we're getting. But when we're talking about the field, is what I don't have to worry about. What I love is, like, I don't have to actually treat the STEMI itself. Well, I just treat this guy's symptoms.
STEMI. Like, we mess that up all the time, because if I say to you as a medic to a medic, they're having a STEMI,
right,
we're talking about what the EKG shows. But what a STEMI is actually blockage, you know, full blockage that requires a stent. So, like, the diagnosis of the like scenario, the environment versus the actual like prognosis of what's going to happen is different, you know?
Yeah. And it's also great. Like,
I was going to say another interesting thing here is that, like, either way, this guy's going to the cath lab. not get a stent, he might get a pacer, but like either way, he's gonna have to end up there. So like the alert is the important piece. Like, hey, this, you know, this is what we got.
Like
CT scanners with strokes, right? They're always gonna get CT scanned anyway. So we need to make sure we get there first. But one thing I would mention is that if let's say, I think you said Red Medic was fairly certain that this was a third degree. Like we're talking about third degree, it's like, what do we know are our STEMI mimics, right? So when we're looking at a STEMI, we have to look at STEMI mimics. One of our common STEMI mimics would be a ventricularly paced rhythm, right? Because it has a large QRS. But what do we know about a third degree? We've got something pacing the upper chambers and we have something pacing the bottom chambers. So we're going to have wide QRSs on. We basically have a version of a ventricular rhythm in a third degree heart block because you have the ventricles pacing themselves typically if you have a wide QRS and you have the upper chambers pacing themselves, the atria, right?
I have really no idea what that.
You do kind of have to watch out for, maybe this is just looking like a STEMI because I have a warped QRS that's larger because I have a block.
You know? So like something I wouldn't do in this situation is give nitro or morphine. Wouldn't do that right now.
You know? Especially because he's super hypertensive.
But to that point, like there, again, that whole, that can happen because sometimes you're so protocol driven that you look at this, you say STEMI, you think oxygen, nitro, and it's not, and again, like I would say, it's not like this crazy idea that couldn't actually happen. I've seen this happen where people are like hypotensive and bradycardic and we're given nitro. And I'm like, I don't understand. They're like, well, because he had chest pain, because he was, and it's like, you gotta, again, you have to understand the algorithm, to Jason's point before you. And Chris, you made the point too, like you have to understand the algorithm to know when and how to deviate from it. Right. So like you gotta be able to do both, you know? Well, so
this is the problem. Like I see this in ACLS classes all the time. Cause you'll teach them an algorithm and then you'll give them a scenario of another algorithm than what they just saw. And then jump right into it. Right. And it's like, no, like this is, you're in the wrong algorithm right now. You're in the ACS algorithm. I want you to be right now in the unstable bradycardia algorithm. That's what we're dealing with, you know? So you got to kind of know, that's where the whole cookbook, like, don't mix up your recipes too much.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Right.
What a great analogy for this Hex Kitchen episode.
I know, right.
Yes.
It's all coming together.
Whenever I hear Hex, I just think HEX, and because we were talking about Harry Potter earlier. And so I'm just like, oh no.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, alrighty. All right. So,
prophylactic fibrillation.
Yeah. Still stands.
Still stands.
Let's do it 8 times unsynchronized. Just go.
Give me enough time. I can make this asystole, and I damn well know what to do with asystole.
Yeah. We're just going to wait here until I know what to do.
Anyway, so it sounds like the summary of your points here would be that this is absolutely appropriate to make a STEMI alert from understanding that at the end of the day, it might not actually be a heart block, like, or it might not actually be a STEMI, an occlusion, you know, an occlusive MI. This might be a, like, this pattern might be resulting from this hypoperfusive state. But in the field, this is sort of a, like, given what we have, it would, it's a good choice to call it. To the point of the third degree, where we have this like ventricular pattern, like with the paced rhythms, Scarbosa criteria would apply, and I would imagine it would apply here because it would have that kind of left bundle branch block appearance. With a wider QRS, there'd still be like depression in V1, V2, and V3, and there's like concordant elevation in lead 2. So that would further add weight to my decision to make this a STEMI. But again, like if you get the perfusion up, do a repeat 12 lead, and then you could kind of reevaluate. And then you just essentially go to the hospital and go like, hey, yeah, this is our STEMI activation. Hey, I got his blood pressure up and the EKG changed. Here you go. And let those people, let Dr. Ramsites figure it out.
Right.
We earned our goddamn cookie.
If I call Dr. Sites and I sent him this EKG and I say STEMI alert, Dr. Sites, what are you going to tell me? What are you going to tell me to have done already? Like, why haven't you started pacing them?
You know what I mean? Why haven't you paced them?
The underlying problem. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like sending a systole and being like, I'm diagnosing death here.
Yeah.
Cool. Have you started CPR? Like,
wait, what?
What?
What? I got called one time for a call, and you have to pronounce you got to call the hospital to get a pronouncement. So I got the call and they said, we got this kind of younger guy. He's like in his 50s, you know, went in cardiac arrest. We got here. It was asystole. We've been doing CPR for about 15 minutes, which I didn't think was that long for a young guy. Yeah. That's just me personally, but yeah. They're like, and, you know, we'd like to call for a pronouncement. And I was like, well, I don't know. Like, so I started asking questions and they're like, well, we've already stopped compressions. And I'm like, well, then the time of death is whenever you stop doing compression. I don't know what to tell you. Like, that's, I mean, it's, you know, so
yeah. Yeah, 15 minutes, man. Yeah, most people say, like, especially with that age range, at least 30 to 40 minutes of working on.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was interesting. But he didn't make it, clearly.
Right.
All right. Well, continuing on, RedChef believes this is an inferior STEMI and they're worried about right ventricular involvement given the appearance. They do not have transmission capabilities in Hex Kitchen, so they will have to activate the cath lab en route. The patient is given aspirin and the non-invasive blood pressure or the autocuff comes back with the very helpful numbers of ?3/?3.
Perfect. So we cycle it again, obviously, to get the number we want.
Well, dude, obviously. Yeah. Maybe it'll come back with exclamation points. You don't know.
That would be more helpful.
Right. That would be more helpful.
You know, like.
So the team carefully removed the patient from the chair and via mega mover, take him to the stretcher, which was brought inside, and they expertly plate the patient in the supine position. Current vitals are: patient's level of consciousness, alert to verbal, heart rate 28, still in the heart block. Blood pressure is anyone's guess, but fluid is being pushed in via the IV, and the SpO2 is not reading great, but when they hold it to the patient's finger and, you know, kind of clamp down on it, they get 98% with room air, and they do note that the pleth wave correlates with the pulse. So,
okay.
All right. Once in the ambulance, Red Chef requests a firefighter to ride in because in this service, fire cannot drive their ambulances. And they figured that there's a high chance for the patient to go into a cardiac arrest. They depart.
How's their heart rate doing with those fluids? Interesting. I don't know if fluid helps heart rate, but that's just my call. We'll keep going. We'll just keep listening.
They depart code 3 towards the closest hospital, which, again, fully capable of dishing out all the needed treatments. God, the puns are so good. All right. It's 20 minutes dishing to get out their code. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Plated the patient. Yeah.
I wait until their decision road has a fork in it.
It's coming up. It's coming up.
Yep. Oh, good. Good.
Yeah. They were on scene for a total of 15 minutes. All right. So they do place the patient on an end-tidal CO2 cannula to monitor the patient's breathing/cardiac output. And they get a value of 20 millimeters of mercury at a rate of 19. Again, it's non-labored. They also place the defibrillator pads on the patient. The patient's SpO2 remains at 99% and the patient remains conscious. They try for another manual BP because now 500 mils of fluid is in and they still can't get a blood pressure. The patient's heart rate.
Those pads do something else. Damn it.
Yeah, I know. That's what
why'd you put the pads on? What is the point of the pads?
In case he dies. Those
they're
pads
doing,
in case
the they're doing the exact thing that Jason said. They're going to wait for this guy to go into asystole because then
right
know what to do.
All right. Yeah. Patient's heart rate still 29 on the monitor.
Yeah,
they administer 1 milligram of atropine to the patient, hoping that it might help increase the cardiac output, but to no avail.
Yeah.
Meds aren't going to work very great.
No. All right. So here we are. Here's our decision fork, fork in the road. And like a fork, well, like one of the serving forks, there's 3 prongs.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Yeah. Not like a regular fork where there's the fork.
We're at our decision.
That's why they call it a fork. Yeah.
So this is a 3. Okay.
Well, that would be a trident, sir. This is a trident. Decision trident.
Sorry, Poseidon. Go ahead.
So
we Red Chef a really cool weapon and make it sound like just the nerdiest. Oh, that's my 3. It's my 3.
Right. Well, you heard from that that one corn song, corn, another cooking thing. Threak on a leash.
So, oh, yeah. A threak on a leash. Is that a mace? Is that, I don't know. This is bad.
Oof. All right. So Red Chef is considering how to best cook up a treatment for this patient. They are considering the following available recipes. And again, I am curious to hear all your thoughts on this after I break down their plan and their thinking. So here they are, those treatment options. Number one, pace the patient. Number two, start a dopamine drip.
Yes.
They have a dopamine bag with a micro drip set. And number three, start a dirty epi drip, which is where they essentially put 1 milligram of 1 to 1,000 epi in a liter bag and use a macro drip at 15 drops per minute, which gets them to their set rate.
Dirty epi drip is what they called that.
Yeah. Dirty. Now, Red thinks that pacing might be helpful in this instance, but this is their thought. They think that this is not just a rate problem. They feel that the patient doesn't have any preload or afterload, despite the 500 mils of fluid, because of the type of MI that they believe this is in. So they are inclined to move towards a pressor first because they feel it would treat more than just the rate problem, which the pacer, they feel the pacer would treat. So the pressors, again, they have the two to choose from. Dopamine, they thought about this first because of the beta effects at the 10 microgram per kilogram per minute rate, or epi, which has both the alpha and beta effects, but they would want to be cautious with this route because they don't want to increase the afterload too much. So they ultimately settle on the following plan. They are going with the less invasive pressor plan over pacing, and they start with a conservative 2 micrograms per minute of epi and plan to titrate up as needed. And then if that doesn't work, they will move on to dopamine. However, their backup plan is if the patient's mental status declines any further, they would just start pacing the patient. So they inform the patient of the plan, and they start their epi at 30 drops per minute. And this is piggybacked into the liter of bag of saline that's still being infused. All right. So thoughts here. Okay. I want to go in more in depth than this afterward, because I definitely have questions. But which plan would you go with?
So really quick, for half a second, I thought you were about to say Lasix when you were kind of going through some words. I'm like, where did that even come from?
You could have, you know what? It would have been just as effective. Sorry, right?
Their protocol doesn't have push dose epi in it, but it has Lasix administration in the back of the
Yeah, exactly. We'll go into depth later. So I will say, and I'll briefly state a reason. I'm definitely leaning towards pacing on this guy. My main reason being is I understand the thoughts of like, hey, if he's having an MI, that can affect how hard his heart's squeezing in the first place. I totally get that. But even if you have a heart that's only doing a half-assed job faster is probably going to be okay. And my concern is that the other thing that I don't think they're really thinking of is that, as Dr. Seitz already mentioned, hypotension can also be affecting the heart as well. And so this hypotension is, if an MI is impacting his heart's ability to push blood out, hypotension is not making that better. It's probably making that worse. And so I would tend to go the pacing route because pacing is a little bit quicker. And then here's kind of my other justification for it. This isn't the best justification. If I'm recalling correctly, American Heart Association says, hey, an unstable, high degree bradycardia, go to pace.
Whoever submitted this, they're not my listener, they're your listener. So I can, okay. This is the example. Maybe you sat in some cool, dirty epi conversation. Who the hell cares? This is not understanding the basics of physiology.
Right.
Epinephrine and dopamine don't act on the heart in the same way that they act on the periphery. So when you have someone who's bradycardic and hypotensive, fixing the vascular problem, which is what you're essentially doing first. And I understand people say like, oh, but epi and dopamine work on the heart too. Sure. Like if you wanted to do that, then you'd give a push dose of epi. That would have been more effective if you're trying to affect the heart.
And my question for you, actually, I'll save this question for later here, but let me go ahead and put it out. Sorry, Jason, go ahead. I'm cutting everybody off.
I was just going to say, I'm not just leaning towards option A. I'm jumping off a cliff.
Right.
Yeah.
100% I would pace, but I do think that to Chris's point, this is a, I have to say Dr. Seitz, sorry, Dr. Seitz.
Oh, good.
But this, I think this is kind of a classic example of maybe like overthinking it. Like this medic obviously has a lot of knowledge about like, here's where the blockage is. So I know there's a preload issue and those are great things to know. We're going to give atropine, that's fine. But with an unstable, it's Edison before medicine. Every time they're unstable, it's Edison before medicine.
Cause he did electricity.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, what about Tesla? Hold on.
Tesla before,
right? Before Twitter.
So a catecholamine drip is typically like a third or at least second line right. treatment, right? Like there's never really a time when I'm going to give atrophy. If I have a stabler bradycardia or they're, you know, they're responding well to the atropine and I want to continue pharmacological, but like I say this all the time, like if we have pacing capabilities, it's not too often that I'm going to use dopamine or epi in a drip form in order to keep blood. That's a longer transport. Like if you don't have the ability to pace them long term, you know what I mean? Like it doesn't really make any sense to use that. Like we can use that as a bridge to get them to a pacer. We can use it in a couple of different ways. But like if you have a pacer, you need to be pacing the bradycardia. You know that's going to handle the issue. Why not shotgun method it and we'll be good to go, you know? Right. And that's going to help with hypotension. It's going to help with, because we're going to be pacing up the heart. Like the preload thing, like if you're continuing to have an issue while you're pacing, that's when I would start going to catecholamines because it's my only other option. And this is a third line treatment. They're not responding to the pacer. Maybe the pacer is not working. Maybe I run out of batteries, you know, whatever. Yeah. Then I can start leaning towards dopamine or epinephrine. But I would say this, and they might not have this in their protocol. Like most protocols don't have, like most EMS protocols, I would say right now at least, don't necessarily have push dose epi options. Doc, yeah. So it might be that.
Yeah, we more do. And more they're getting them, I think. Drip.
Like in our area, they for sure have been like, yeah, you want to keep the engine going? Use starter fluid. I mean,
And to be clear, they don't have push dose epi at this service. And their protocol does allow for these three options, from my understanding, from my discussion with them. And this was one of those where everyone had different ideas.
Does it allow for them in unstable bradycardia or in a hypotensive instance? Because, again, you're in the wrong cookbook. Like, that's the problem, right? So.
So this might be one of those where, you know, like we have for the ground service I work at, if you're in cardiogenic, you know, quote unquote cardiogenic shock, I have a full array of treatments. Although, again, it's like there's a protocol specifically for bradycardia in which it goes like, hey, is it unstable versus stable?
And that's a pretty typical.
But that's the problem with that algorithm, in my opinion, and bringing epi and dopamine into it, is because if you have a stable bradycardia, what are you doing for that patient? If you have an unstable bradycardia, it's not like you're then going like, well, is it super unstable or just semi-unstable? Well, if it's super, I'll go with the electricity. If it's just semi, I'll go with the pharmacology. That's not how we're supposed to look
at it. And I think you're bringing up a pretty good point as to kind of where, I absolutely agree with you, Dr. Seitz, in the sense of like, hey, this is what ACLS says, but I think there's, not that it's a great excuse, but I think there may be some system issues that are kind of outside the individual medic's control that may be pushing in on this. But I know, Spencer, you want to get to the deeper issues later, but that's a good discussion. I think that'll probably dominate the episode when we get through the call here.
Excellent. All right. Well, then let's go forward because I have a lot of questions to follow up on this. So let's see what happens with Red Chef. So they check vitals every 5 minutes. For level of consciousness, they continue having a conversation with the patient because they really want to make sure that mental status doesn't drop so they don't have to pace. They talk with the patient about biking during the transport, and the patient is very conversive and engaged in that conversation because if you bike 20 miles regularly, you're probably going to be wanting to talk about bikes. Again, using that as a metric for the mental status, they try to auto cuff and manual cuff blood pressures, but they cannot get a value. End-tidal CO2 is at 23 with respirations at 17. SpO2 is 96% on room air and heart rate is 33. The next set of vitals are essentially the same with a mild increasing of the heart rate to 35. They do look for another IV site on the other arm, but they don't find any good sites. They also had the discussion with the fire department, sort of pre-gaming about what should happen if the patient should code, and they have their airway equipment set out. They give a 10-minute heads up to the hospital for the cath lab activation. And in Hex Kitchen, the cath lab staff are always there during the day. And this service, the EMS service, also boasts a 98% accuracy rate for field activations. For the ones activated, that is not the overall sensitivity.
I was going to ask, does that include, is that just the ones they activate, or are we including any missed ones?
That is just the ones that they're like, this is a STEMI.
The real obvious ones, we get them almost every time.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little bit, I'll talk about that statistic later, because I'm a little bit worried about it. But anyway, let's push on.
All right. So now, between that time and about 5 minutes out from the hospital, the patient is noted to start having small runs of VTAC. And there is now some concern expressed with their treatment plan. Red does have the med kit out and amiodarone and code epi out, like set aside, drawn up just in case. And there is about 250 mils left in their normal saline. So their plan would be to shut down the epi drip, put the 150 milligram of amiodarone into that and run that over 10 minutes if the patient's VTAC persisted. They also have an IO out and ready if the patient decides to code as well. But at 5 minutes out, they do finally get some improvement in their vitals. Heart rate is now 43. Blood pressure is now 110 over 60 via the auto cuff. And they confirmed that on the opposite arm with a manual cuff of 106 at 60, or 106 over 60. End tidal is 28. Respirations are 14 and 98% on room air. And the patient's skin is now notably drier and the patient is more arousable. And I'm glad that they checked the blood pressure in the other arm too.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's nice. What did the blood pressure come out to again?
So 110 over 60 via gotcha. The auto cuff. And then in the other arm, they did a manual and got 106 over 60. So.
Gotcha. And what was the heart rate again?
Heart rate is a whopping 43.
Wow, dang.
Yeah, see, I'm wondering here what's happening is they're seeing a guy, an athletic man, talk to them pretty clearly about biking, and they're thinking that his resting heart rate is super low in general. Mm-hmm. So they're missing the unstable bradycardia because...
Well, I was just going to say...
A little bradycardic versus, you know what I mean, for him.
Right.
I'm not convinced this guy's still not going to die because I think that we've just been waiting. Like, I don't really think they've done anything at this point to really... In my mind, if this guy survives, and I don't know what happens in this case, but if he survives, it's only because he's healthy. Because right. I would actually be alarmed if you had no blood pressure and all of a sudden your blood pressure popped to over 100 systolic, you're about to code.
Yeah.
Because your body just peripherally shunted everything.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? Like you're about, like that to me would be like, oh shoot.
Well, in all fairness, they did give epi, so it is going to start peripherally shunting. I mean, there's that.
Right. So, yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
So I didn't understand the IO thing. They have an IO ready in case they code, but they have IV access, right? So they wouldn't need.
They do have IV access, but they were thinking like, oh, if we have to do multiple more fluid, or you know, okay. They wanted a second line, but they didn't. They didn't want to get a second line as an IO.
I've done unless similar.
The patient was out.
I've done similar, especially in packed ambulances. So that way, if there's someone at the end of the bench, they can push drugs and then I can be up here doing something with this IV. Just that way I don't have to jump, you know, no one has to jump over or pass drugs around. They're just,
yeah, I got you.
They're all in the wall. Yeah. So I can see a logistic value in that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, as they roll into the ED, they go to the trauma bay, are greeted by the team, and the patient is taken to the cath lab. And here is the follow-up. Prior to the procedure, they did get some temporary pacing due to the instability prior to the cath lab.
Sounds about
they
right.
They weren't paced in the ER when the crew was there. Essentially, it was just sort of, you know, they watched him for a bit and then immediately took him out. They stented. They actually placed multiple stents. They determined that the primary cause of STEMI was the complete occlusion of the distal RCA. Then they had a 95% occlusion of the mid LAD. They Jesus. Also noted, but did not stent the LM1 vessel. And they found that the patient had a little bit of hypo-K. And their initial troponin at the ED came back at 0.01. The patient did try and die twice during the cath procedure, but lived and walked out of the hospital 2 days later. You could say this Hex Kitchen surprise challenge was well done. But now, you know, we need to Maybe know. Not. Could it have been done better? After the call, Red and Blue Chef discussed it, and Blue Chef expressed that going to Pressers first was appropriate, but felt that dopamine would have been the best flavor for this patient over Epi. And so now here we go. I want to know, pacing better.
I think that's like, I think that's like arguing nutmeg versus cinnamon when you're cooking like freaking like a steak.
Right.
The issue is we're discussing the wrong thing after the call. I'm actually surprised that the ER after there was no transmission capabilities, right?
Right.
No transmission.
Still, I'm surprised that the ER, it's disappointing that the ER didn't start pacing that guy. Yeah,
for sure. How long were they in the ER though?
I don't remember.
Honestly, like, and I would bet my career on this right now. Like, this is how sure I am. The only reason this man survived is because of his own, like, granted he had blockages, right?
Right.
But his cardiovascular health saved him. The medics just happened to be a faster Uber driver. Like, and I'm not trying to be a dick, but like, it's true.
You
are.
I'm not trying to be a dick, but sorry.
None of that makes, the pathology, pathophysiology behind the decision is incorrect in my mind. Like,
yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. Well, but anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, let's jump into that. Let's jump, since that's sort of the big elephant in the room, let's talk about those treatments. Was the rationale about pacing where they're like, hey, we want to increase the rate, but I'm worried about I believe they're preload dependent and I need to give them, you know, like, I don't think we've given them enough preload with the fluid that we've given already. Like, is that fair? Is there a downside to pacing in this situation?
I mean, I don't know if anybody else wants to jump in. I disagree with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Preload literally, like, one, you have to, like, so I guess I'm trying to understand why they thought that the preload was so bad.
I think because they were probably concerned about right ventricular involvement. I think that's where they were really running with it, but there's no V4R and even still, I'm going to kind of circle back to this is that, when we're talking about preload, there's a lot of things. So preload is literally not this matters a little bit just so people can know, but preload is literally measured by sarcomere stretch in the right atria, I believe, right, which you can't measure in a living patient, by the way. So basically that can be affected by largely by the amount of fluid that's going in, but that has to come from cardiac output.
So that, I guess that's the thing. So that's where I'm going with this. So are they incorrect in thinking that if you had like a very, like an inferior wall, right-sided MI, that it's preload dependent? Yes. But adding fluid to a pump that's not pumping, like you're missing the key, you use preload for cardiac output. Like cardiac output is the piece that like we have to. So I could add a ton of fluids to an asystolic heart too. What does that do for me though? So it's like, does that make sense? I guess that's kind of where I'm like, Jason, maybe you can explain a little bit better, but I feel like that's where I'm kind of like, I guess you're not wrong, but what in this situation made you think that like, you thought about pacing clearly. So you clearly realized that there needed to be, you know, more contractility and the rate needed to come up. Cardiac output is literally like based on heart rate. That's the key piece here.
Right.
Playing with preload and afterload would be a secondary thing in my mind.
And I think when we're boiling it down to kind of one of the things that strikes me, and given that what I'm about to say, this logic doesn't apply to every treatment every single time for everything. And I absolutely understand that. So I don't want listeners to think that like, well, this isn't necessarily true. But a lot of times what I try and look at is the potential causes for this and one that's not on there. Because we talk about hypotension or blood pressure. It's supported by how good your pump's doing, how much fluid you have going around the circulatory system, and how big the pipes are. That's it. And so I'm trying to think which of those things are most likely impacting this heart. One that's probably not is lack of fluid. We don't really have necessarily trauma. He may have just sweated a whole bunch, but for an athlete that's used to this, that bikes all the time, that's really low on my list. And so my first thing isn't to like, well, let's give the fluid back, because my problem with that is the heart had plenty of fluid. It had that and it still fucked it up. So I don't know if I want to go back to doing more fluid, especially when you have something that's this bradycardic. And I kind of go back to, I mean, I, I don't like hypotensive bradycardic patients with terrible EKGs because I think they're going to code soon. And in my mind, and you know, Spence, I don't know if you have a study you're waiting to throw at us that that you just know, but like in my mind, hypotension, it's bad for everything. It is specifically bad for the heart as well in an MI. I mean, am I correct there? I mean, everyone kind of agrees with that.
Yeah.
And so if I mean, their concerns are perfectly valid in the sense that, hey, I mean, it might not be just rate. It might just be that it's not squeezing hard enough. That's probably true, but pacing will help that.
Well, and that's the thing too. So like go ahead, Jason.
There's a difference between being hypovolemic and being hypotensive.
Right. So yeah.
The issue here is that like, if you want to know a way to make me hypotensive right now, slow my heart down to 36 beats per minute. I'll go hypotensive too. That doesn't have anything to do. Is my preload affected? Yeah. Because I'm not getting the fluid that I have in my body, as you said, into the heart. Like I can't, of course my preload's affected, but what I need is to pace my heart up, right? I see this a lot in ACLS scenarios when we have them run a code and then there has to be a post cardiac arrest situation afterwards, right? Mm-hmm. And they'll see a symptomatic bradycardia, or they'll see a bradycardia after the code, and they'll start thinking the less serious routes, let's get them some atropine and it's like the guy just died.
Right.
Of course he's hypotensive and bradycardic. Like we need to, so let's roll. We have pads on him already. Let's roll. Like we don't have to be so fearful of the electricity. It's not this like scary extreme treatment just because we're shocking them. It can be a little uncomfortable for them, but it's not like we're taking their heart rate and we're going to send it into the hundreds.
No, we're not.
You can actually do that on accident with catecholamines. I'm telling the heart, go faster. With pacing, I'm telling the heart, go 60 beats per minute, go the perfect speed.
Right?
There's that big difference. I think we make connections a lot of times in pre-hospital medicine. We talk all the time about how right-sided MIs, that's a preload-dependent heart. That's why we stay away from nitro. That's why we stay away from maybe doing the morphine because the dilation effects. But that's a right-sided MI. That's not an inferior MI. Those two things are separate too. So like, to this guy's point, what I would have liked to have seen, if he's going down that route at all, a right-sided EKG. He didn't even run a right-sided EKG to really confirm, this is preload dependent, to kind of go with his argument, right? So but it's really not our job to decide whether we should even withhold nitro and morphine and those sort of things with dilation when we see that type of situation. It's our job to present that information to the hospital and let them make that decision most of the time. So
the other thing too, to your point with the nitro stuff, Jason, so like I said, preload is essentially, I mean, again, what you're actually measuring is like the stretching of those sarcomeres right as you come into the right side of the heart. But that is dependent on the amount of venous blood flow, right? So the amount of volume. Mm-hmm. And and the ability of that volume to circulate back to that side, right? So you have to have the volume component there, which I would argue that there's not a volume problem. And I would argue that like they can't argue otherwise. They said it was a STEMI. A STEMI is not a volume problem, right? And I get the new thing, but you're not going to like put yourself, you know. So that's not a volume problem. It's the amount of venous blood flow, which we're seeing there's not a problem, and then the rate at which it circulates, which is literally only dependent on the heart rate at that point. And to Jason's point, if you have a right-sided MI, what you don't want to do is give nitro because it could make things worse because you're going to dilate those vessels right before they come in, which decreases essentially that volume coming in because you distributed it out over the area. That's very different than like, I would put the question back to them. What harm did you think pacing would do to preload? Because if you truly understand what causes preload, pacing can only help, right? Because it's going to help the rate component. Now, it may not have an effect, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But it's not going to cause harm. And so, again, I think it's a lack of understanding of what preload really is. Like you've heard preload, people have thrown that at you in class. So you're like, oh, preload dependent, right-sided. But you're jumping to this like, but pacing would be a problem. No, like pacing could only help in that situation. And I would argue too, like you start with pacing. That's why the algorithm says to, you start with pacing. If it doesn't work, then you could try fluid.
You have other options.
Compressors, right? But starting the other way doesn't make any sense. And they started the pressors and stuff and did a bunch of repeat vital signs, and those didn't work either. And they didn't have a secondary, they didn't take the next step for that either. So like, again, I think it's just like, and I'm not saying it's easy, like preload, afterload, like it takes, it's a little nuanced there, but again, that's why the algorithms are there. Like right. That's why they're there. So like, again, I think there's a problem in their understanding of like, it seems like they didn't want to pace because they thought somehow pacing would cause a preload problem, but I'm not sure where that comes from. Right.
I think they thought the right side was causing a preload problem, which I understand. Yeah. And I also think that they're the first mistake, and it's easy to Monday morning quarterback. So I'm
sure
to be gentle.
Yeah.
I think the first mistake was giving fluid in the first place. That mistake I can understand. I can understand being on a patient who's diaphoretic, just biked
25
miles and is hypotensive, being like, oh yeah, I'm going to give him fluid. He's
right.
Hypotensive, right?
And that's why I said earlier, like, I'm not necessarily saying, you know, like, I don't think it's a fluid issue, but I can understand how there are situations where you would still try and give fluid to someone who's potentially hypotensive after work. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, just go ahead.
Well, I think though that after the EKG, we see that they're bradycardic. Whenever we see a bradycardic that slow, we should stop thinking about hypotension. Like hypotension is an effect of, you know, it's a side effect of the heart rate. Of course they're hypotensive because they're going slow, right?
Right.
So let's speed them up first. And then if they're still not perfusing decently, well, then we can consider adding a little fluid to there because maybe that hypotension is more fluid dependent. The fluid is either in the wrong space or it's not there, right? So we have to kind of figure out how to get it into the right space, or we need to add some.
Right.
So it's not this end all be all, add fluid, it'll solve the problems. That heart's not going to beat any faster because it has more fluid. That doesn't make sense.
You know? I would also Jason, I got a couple questions for you there. So I want to talk about two of the treatments. I want to talk about, Jason, you brought up that, you know, they may have had some concerns that that pacing would cause a problem. It wasn't really fleshed out why. I agree with you. It really seemed like they wanted to do like anything but pacing. And I didn't really see a clear reason why they seem to feel that way.
I think that's culture. I think in generally in EMS, the way that we teach it, the way that we present it, I think that paramedics tend to be a little fearful of pacing and again, that's why I tried to really make it simple. Like it's actually safer than any meds because there's a cap on it. I can't go faster than 6. No one
hurts
getting paced. And then all of a sudden went to 220. I mean, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
You
know? So
it's a very effective treatment. It's pretty non-invasive. It's not even that uncomfortable, to be honest. You know, I know people are like, well, then I got to get pain meds because they're going to be so uncomfortable. It ain't that bad.
Well, and here's the other thing too, is like, I mean, I'm big into keeping my patients comfortable, but I'm also big into keeping them alive.
Right.
And so if I'm, and I totally agree, like this guy's super hypotensive, I'm not about to give him, I don't know what sedation they carry, but, you know, for the longest time, Spence and I worked in a place that carried fentanyl and Versed. Those were your two choices. And if anything, I'm thinking, I'm like, oh, you know what? Maybe a little pain will help his sympathetic tone go up. But but kind of back to the point of like, so we're talking about, so pacing, like, again, like aside from that discomfort, I don't really see a downside to it, but I do see some downsides to potential downsides, both to giving pressors and fluid. My big thing about fluid, I don't like giving fluid to sick hearts because it has a tendency to go places it's not supposed to go, like Jason brought up, like the lungs. Right. You know, I mean, we're pretty sure it's right-sided failure, which means we're not going to back up into the lungs. But from my perspective is I don't know exactly what's failing, and I don't know if there may be some left-sided failure as well. And so we don't know where that fluid's going to end up in a pump that's just not good at pumping fluid around right now. And so I worry about that. Again, I'm not saying there's not a point which fluid may become part of the treatment, but it's certainly after pacing in my book.
I think what was happening is we're looking at it and we're saying STEMI, which they were right. Don't get me wrong. They were right. It's a STEMI. Yeah. And they were looking and they're hypotensive instead of saying this is primarily an unstable bradycardia and there's a STEMI complication with it.
Right.
And I'll throw this in there too. Right. So if you're in a STEMI protocol, what type of medications do we give? Nitro,
which we're not going to,
or morphine, and we're not going to do that.
Dilated.
But we're going to give something to constrict the peripheral down. Like I would argue that you could have, and it sounds like hopefully this didn't happen. I don't, it sounds like this had a good outcome, but like you could have, you're also going to clamp down the coronaries. So like you could have made the MI worse in some ways if you're not careful. Right.
That's
like,
a good point.
Again, you've got to just, and I get that, like to Jason's point, like there is maybe some gray, but there is a lot of black and white we missed, and you can't play in the gray unless you have understood the black and white. Right. So you can't have your cake and eat it too. Right. It's one or the other.
Yeah, Spencer, yeah. Going back and reviewing, because I want to give credit where credit's due. They ended up going with EpiDrip, correct?
So they used it at a 2 microgram per minute drip. And this is where I actually don't have the answer here. At what point, if you were going to drip Epi in to increase chronotropy, what rate would you have to have that at?
For Epi for adult bradycardia, you want 2 to 10 micrograms per minute.
Okay.
Okay. And so they were at 2. Yeah, they're at the lowest.
That's the ACLS algorithm. If you look at ACLS algorithm, 2 to 10 mics per minute. But let's say they paced first and it didn't work, because that could have happened, right?
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
I still think you should have. They paced first, it didn't work. So now you follow the algorithm. What's the second thing you do? You start an EpiDrip at 2 to 10.
Gotcha.
You started it at 2 and you still couldn't get a blood pressure. Why was it never titrated?
That's a good point.
You know what I mean? So again, like, no matter, you got to commit. You can't do the bare minimum of everything and then walk away and be like, yeah, I think we did it. Like,
well, it's not even really the bare minimum. The bare minimum is a titrate.
Right. So it's kind of like, that's what I mean. Like, so had they said, you know what, we're going to do Epi, and they had titrated for like 2 to 4 to 6, like that. Okay. Yeah. At least you're, again, I think there's like a lot of missing pieces here. And now I think after the fact, they want to think about like, well, dopamine would have been better. Like, it's a moot point. We need to talk about what.
Yeah.
Like, that's an aside, right? I mean, it's kind of like, you know.
So, so let me just kind of make sure I'm kind of to summarize the group's feelings. I think we're all pretty much on board that pacing was the primary treatment for this guy to start with. And just to kind of clarify something, I don't know if you guys have the AHA algorithm in front of you, just to make sure that what I'm saying is correct. Pacing is the first line, and it's not suggesting an epi drip until after that. Correct.
Right. It's an alternative, I believe, for unstable. I'll double check though.
Yeah. Just kind of,
I just want to get unstable bradycardia. Like, and I'll say unstable by AHA guidelines is even technically, and I'm not saying that I recommend this, but technically unstable from AHA guidelines, even if the guy's blood pressure had been fine, his chest pain actually makes him unstable, and you could have paced him just for that, like just for the chest pain component. Now, then we can have a conversation about like, well, I mean, let's try some other things. I think that's fine, but
yeah.
So it's a frontline dose of atropine.
Gotcha.
Yep.
And then it says if atropine is ineffective, transcutaneous pacing and or a dopamine or epinephrine infusion. And that would be 2 to 10. So they're not wrong. I just don't know why. That's why it drove me crazy when you were like, they put the pads on them in case he codes. And it's like, so they have pads. I know they can pace.
Right. You know,
that's what we should be doing, right? Because we know that it's going to be more effective.
Yeah. When it's kind of coming down to it, I think their confusion on scene with this is a little bit, at least more understandable in terms of which one, because that algorithm doesn't really give you much guidance in that sense.
Yeah, but that's like saying, here's the problem. It's saying they got the right answer, but how did they get to one of the right answers? They didn't get the most best answer.
Exactly.
They got to a technically correct answer, but they did it in kind of a janky way by talking about hypotension a bunch.
Yeah.
Preload, and like, it didn't really relate to that, right? Like the issue here, bradycardia wasn't really concentrated on at all in their assessment. And that's what... That's where they were saying, I think epinephrine's better. I think dopamine's better because hypotension.
Sure.
No, you're not. We're trying to get the heart rate back up, you know?
Well, gotcha. So to clarify, it really does sound like then all those three treatments are possible treatments, although the preference is pacing, because it's like the downsides to pacing are that you might not capture, or you think you capture, because there are pseudo capture waves that can show up on an EKG where you're like, oh, look at that, I've got capture, when you really haven't. You should always palpate a pulse with your to make sure that you have capture. Or there might be pain, and we are very reluctant, I think, to hurt people. And oftentimes drugs seem like kind of the way to not hurt people. So I can understand the thought there. And it sounds like the medic in this case, Red Chef, just sort of had a misunderstanding and was misapplying something they'd learned about preload from a, you know, inferior, possibly right-sided MI, and applying that to this situation unnecessarily, which made it murky. And that was like, and if they had paced, that would have also helped get fluid back to the heart, mm-hmm. because the heart is pushing out more fluid. Therefore, you're getting more preload back,
right?
Because you're getting more fluid moving around.
So I want to counter
the same thing, because the epi didn't raise his heart rate.
Can I just throw in here? Cause I needed to look it up. Cause like,
yeah,
it didn't sit right with me. Like the and, or
yeah.
Sure. That's what the algorithm says. The AHA also very clearly, cause I just looked it up. It says, for the patient with symptomatic bradycardia with signs of poor perfusion, not just symptomatic, signs of poor perfusion, transcutaneous pacing is the treatment of choice.
Gotcha.
So, okay. Like, I was going to say, like, I get that you can use the others, but like, that would have been a good example if he was having like crushing chest pain, but his blood pressure was fine. Let's pace him with like, but he's got like crazy signs of poor perfusion on top of it.
Oh, absolutely.
Pacing is still, is still the recommended, like the ones we should use.
So well, that's what I second or third line treatment, like epi and dopamine are our backups when our pacer is down.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Well, and this actually circles back to what Seitz said, Chris Seitz said in the beginning. And that is like, you need to understand you got to understand why you do these algorithms you do, because in this case, as we just showed, blindly following the algorithm doesn't provide you with a lot of guidance. It gives you an and, or it gives you this, but if you read the logic behind it, like you just did, Chris, the decision's much clearer in that case with that.
Well, and I'll go back to you too, again, the kind of like the preload question here. It's like the chicken or the egg type of thing, right? Like, and I go back to, you know, if you understand how preload works, I think you would have thought, you know what? Well, let's pace them first, because that is an easy solve to one of the preload issues. And if it's not that, we'll know right away, and then we can start other things. Yeah. You know what I mean? So I think it's kind of going, I think they got to maybe not the best answer, but a answer.
Yeah.
But with the wrong logic, which like that's more dangerous, I think, than, and this is the value of going back and looking over it, is going back. And this is why Jason and I do the Back to Basics podcast, like taking it back to basics. What is preload, right? What really is preload? I even learned this as a physician. I still do this to this day as a physician. It may make people uncomfortable, but you'd be surprised how many times, like I see a patient, I picked up a midnight shift the other day, and I saw a patient with like, they had like Hashimoto's thyroiditis and like this thyroid issue. And then they were having like symptoms. No joke. I had some downtime in the shift. I'm looking up like T4 and T3 and how the thyroid functions again, because that's always served me better. When I take the time to go look at that, all of a sudden, like everything falls into place after that. When I truly understand just how the thyroid works, all of a sudden I'm like, oh, that makes sense that this medication does this and this and this and this and this and this, right? If you understand how preload works, all of a sudden you understand why the algorithm says this and then this or that. And it starts to like make a lot more sense from that way. Because again, in this scenario, you've got someone who's very bradycardic, very symptomatic with poor perfusion. And you're thinking to yourself, okay, I've got to get their blood pressure up. But getting someone's blood pressure up has, like, from a physiology standpoint, doesn't also increase their heart rate. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's right. Not like,
yeah.
Like, it can decrease their heart rate. Actually, like, think about like someone who's like septic, they're like crazy tachycardic. That's how the body works, right? If my blood pressure goes down, my heart rate goes up to compensate for it. That's my compensatory mechanism.
Yeah.
So treating the blood pressure and hoping the heart rate will go up doesn't really make intuitive sense, but treating a heart rate and then that does. So like starting with the right thing, and could that have done absolutely nothing? Absolutely. But we at least checked the right box, because now we can have a conversation about like which one, epi or dopamine. Right now we can't even really have that conversation because we didn't deal with the rate problem to begin with. So it's kind of like, well, I don't know if that, I don't know anything would have made a difference at that point, you know?
Yeah.
So. Spencer, we're always like turning things on and we're turning things off, right? Yeah. So like there's always like side effects, but I feel like I've said this in lectures before, where like if you have a cardiac arrest patient, like I've had students come to me and be like, should we be giving epi and cardiac arrest? What if they have a history of heart issues and now they're going to wake up super tachycardic and that's going to give them a heart attack? And it's like, well, you're right to think along those lines. It's true that those things like can happen, but what do you think the priority is, right?
I think
that in terms of turning things off and turning things on, I can't very quickly or effectively reverse the effects of a chronotropic drug.
Oh, just draw it back out.
I can just turn the pacer off though.
We go to dialysis clinics all the time. Just, okay. Stop by one of those. Like, hey,
actually, trust me, Jason, if you draw enough blood out, you'll see the blood pressure come back down. That's pretty sure.
It works.
So guys, I mean, I think we could, there's some other things I do want to move past. I think we kind of got this one good, but I want to bring up one other thing. Cause I have to have the last word. So Spencer, you had brought up some downsides to pacing that I do think are worth mentioning. Cause we kind of like, why would you avoid pacing? Yes. You do have to have the mechanical capture and you have to be good at verifying. But one of the things that I want to point out is you have to do that with anything you give. So the same issues in terms of assessing that it's working are going to be present if you're giving a presser as well, with the exception of you don't have to sit there and make sure your pressure gets capture, I guess. But at the end of the day, you are still going to have to verify with a pulse, verify that everything on your machine is as, because let's say you increase the heart rate with Epi and it does come up for whatever reason, and maybe it won't, but if it does, you still need to check a blood pressure. You still need to check and make sure that what's happening is what you want. So you're going to have that either way. And I think where this crew really kind of seemed to get hung up is they would try treatments and they would keep trying to verify that those treatments were actually doing something, even when the blood pressure was coming back as bleh, and it's kind of like, how long are we going to go down this road? But anyway, so I think probably the final word on that, and Jason, thanks for grabbing the AHA stuff on that. I think yeah, where the crew probably, to me, in my opinion, their biggest misstep when it came to this is, Jason, like you said, they chose an answer. And if you go just by the algorithm, there's not a lot of guidance there. But I think to me that the hard line in the sand is that if you read the logic behind that algorithm in the AHA guidelines, in the actual book itself, it says pacing is the way. If you can't do pacing, then you add this, or if pacing doesn't work, then you add this. And I admit, I have had patients where they are hard to get capture on. They're just plain difficult. That happens. But anyway, so I think
I'll throw in a quick little caveat here too, because you guys may see this like in the ER, we'll intravenously pace, right?
Yeah.
Mm. I'm a hard proponent that we should never be doing that.
Oh, really?
And here's my argument for it, right? If I have time to go drop an intravenous pacer, right, and do an invasive procedure like that, this patient just needs to go to cath lab.
Oh, very right? True.
Like, why am I holding them up in my ear to put an intravenous pacer so that they can then later go to cath lab and get? So, like, now if I don't have a cath lab and I'm going to transport this guy's, I can't get mechanical capture, he's bradycardic, and you guys are going to fly him out, I might drop a pacer then, right? Because that's going to be easier. Mm. Barring that, though, I actually don't feel that we should be dropping intravenous pacers in the ER. Because what you'll find too is now you'll start to like pay attention when this happens. How many times are we not even transcutaneously pacing them and dropping an intravenous pacer?
Yeah, like, well, and I don't
least,
know. Like,
this happens all the time. All the time, these ER docs are setting up to do an intravenous pacer, and we're doing the same thing. I do what I preach is what I'm trying to say, that like we're not even transcutaneously pacing them. We're giving them epi and dopamine, stuff like that, and we're like, oh, they need a pacer, I'm gonna go drop an intravenous one. No, I mean, like, the only time I should be ever dropping an intravenous pacer is if I'm transcutaneously pacing someone and not getting a good capture, and I don't have the option to just have the cardiologist go put a permanent one in. I mean, there's really like no other. Yeah. So like, again, like, I like, it's on both ends that this misconception, but again, understanding why you're doing what you're doing is so important. So,
and to this crew's credit, they know the algorithms. And the reason why I know they know at least some of the algorithms very deeply is because he's thinking about right-sided heart failure.
And
so if I asked him about the ACS algorithm, he'd be the first to tell me, hey, I want to hold off on nitro, and that's smart. I want to discuss with medical direction whether I should give, morphine and nitro, because there's some issues there with preload. It's just in this case, this one, we got to know a little bit deeper, that's all.
Yeah. And so I think that's sort of one of the things is like, I think there's the concern, like, hey, if it's a bradycardia patient where there isn't the concern of a STEMI when you do the 12 liter, just like, I don't know, for their whatever reason, they're in a heart block, or, where you don't see that evidence there. I think one of the failings that happens is people see the STEMI pattern and then they go, well, STEMI trumps all. And I wonder if the STEMI pattern alters that bradycardia treatment, and I should be more cautious with pacing or something along those lines. And I think the answer there is no, the treat that low rate first, and then and then worry about the after effects. Like, and
I think there's just a misconception that that pacing is in some way dangerous or terribly uncomfortable. I will say, of everyone I've paced, most of them are pretty much troopers. They sit there like this the entire time, and I'm like, "You okay?" Like, "I'm okay." And I'm like,
"Play some music."
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Like, that's a good beat, man.
So real quick, I think we should just run through the rest of this. I thought their pregame was good with the considerations. They had the nice ribbing of the more senior partner, you know, "Hey, remember your training." For their arrival assessment, I thought they did great on that. The only thing that they didn't capture was a CBG. The whole time
he didn't need Epi and pacing, he needed D10. That's what we missed.
We've already beat to death the treatments. I think it's helpful to have the good rapport with the hospital. Someone had brought up the question about the 98%. You said you wanted to put a pin in that and come back to it. Chris, did you have anything?
I have a huge problem with the way that is gathered. So they're saying that when they call a STEMI, they're 98% of the time they're right. So here's the thing.
Yes.
98% is an astronomically high number. That's one of the things we really got to keep in mind. 98% is really, really good. My problem, though, is that that's a very bizarre way to look at these things. What you should be doing is, when you're really trying to suss out whether or not your STEMI program is working, whether people are making the right call, you have to look at, did they make the right call, whether they made the call or not. So you have to include the misses. And well, here's the thing.
As a medical director, I would, because you're saying like 98% is astronomical, like in healthcare in general, because STEMIs are not as easy as you. So if you're saying 98% as a medical director, I would be like, "Oh, wow, we're missing a ton of STEMIs."
Exactly. That's my point is, because if you are in that group, if you are underdiagnosing STEMIs and you're only looking at the ones you got correct and you're 98% of the time right, you are probably missing a ton of them. I can't say for certain, but you're probably missing a ton of them. So the only statistic that matters is all of them. How many did you get right? How many did you call correctly? How many did you call incorrectly? And how many did you not call at all that you should have? Like, you have to look at that. I am super worried about a 98% number. I mean, again, I'm willing to admit I could be wrong. I just don't think I am on that
studies,
one.
We can't look at the accuracy of whether the STEMI activation turned into a real cath lab, you know, stent put in, because the thing is we don't have that information.
Right. So
what needs to be, we need to be getting attaboys when we see a STEMI on the EKG and it is truly a STEMI on the EKG. I don't care if we're actually having blockage, because the thing is, we're looking at criteria where there's things that we can't check. We can't run troponins. We can't, that's not even an accurate depiction anymore. Right.
You can actually taste it in the blood, but go on.
I saw in my system all the time people going, "Look, here's the thing is, if I look at a STEMI and it's clearly a STEMI on the paper and then it doesn't end up being a STEMI in the hospital, if I'm going to get criticism for a true activation but a incorrect diagnosis, I'm going to stop doing it." But now it seems like that might lead to a 98%.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe.
That's a good point.
Follow your protocol. And you know, when you call in a STEMI alert, you're not saying this, "I will bet my life that this guy will get cath." You're saying it fits the criteria that you want me to check for. You know what I mean? Right. It's the same thing with LVO, like with strokes, right? Like, no, they have receptive and expressive aphasia. They have a score of this on a fast ED. So they're fitting the criteria for an LVO. You know, we think they might have an LVO. Let's go to that thing. They might go to the hospital and they don't have an LVO. That ain't on me. I followed the rule.
Yeah, right. I mean,
that's how we get
it. Absolutely.
There was a hospital I worked at where they missed like two STEMIs. I got to look at these cases as one of the directors, and I don't really think they missed anything. But the best part of the story is that cardiology decided that from now on, they want to see every EKG from EMS. And I was like, "You do you? Okay. You clearly don't understand how the EMS ER system." The less than 24 hours And they were like, stop doing this. Like, every 5 minutes, just get an EKG. Like, it's just like, they're like, we can't. We're like, yeah, did you think that like we only see a couple EKGs a day or something? Like, right. What? It was great. It was the best. Literally less than 24 hours, and they got an email memo that's like, cardiology no longer needs to see everything.
Exactly. Cardiology has collected enough data. Thank you for your participation. Right, yeah, exactly. That's good. All righty. Nice. Well, any good final words, guys?
No, I think it's good. I hope I'm going to say now, after the fact, to the listener who maybe have put this in, and like, I'm sorry if I came down hard on this. Like, again, I'm very passionate about like, I think that we do ourselves, and we do this, I do this, like, and I'm going to take accountability for it as well. Like, we have to give ourselves grace to be comfortable and okay. Again, always going back to the real basic stuff. This is the opportunity here, is really go back to the really, really basic stuff. Like, this is a good outcome. This is, you know, everything's fine. Don't worry about it. Everything turned out fine. There's no big deal. But I think that like, we have to have the humility, especially in the emergency medicine field, and I would say in healthcare in general, we have to have the humility and the accountability to say, hey, you know what? Like, I need to continuously go back to the simple things and the basic things and recognize that like, sometimes those are the most important, right? And go from there. And that does not make us a cookbook medic. That does not make these like connotations of like, I don't have to prove to you that I did. Like, I just have to prove, I just have to know myself that I did the best job I could with the resources and stuff I had. And that always comes back to just like really going back and understanding the basic piece. So that would be my encouragement there. Like I said, like, but also like,
Actually, I'm going to cut the whole episode down to where it's just that.
Just that.
Guy
apologizing.
I mean, we can use that soliloquy right at the beginning as it opens up. Too, you know, it's just as a like
be fantastic.
Yeah, right before the music starts, and then we go into it.
Dr. Seitz's his apology in the beginning, and then he goes out of this, and then he goes out.
All right, well, guys, thanks again for joining us. We really had a lot of fun. It always, of course, lends us some credibility when you guys come on here, so we love it. Thanks for you guys' input. You guys are a lot of fun to podcast with. It really adds to it. It's a ton of fun. So everyone, thanks again for listening. And if you haven't already, please follow us on social media. It is EMS20/20 on Facebook, at EMS2020 show on Instagram. If you would like your call to appear on this show, and after Dr. Seitz today, I don't know why you would, but if you, I'm sorry, man. I had to poke that button one more time. But if you want your call to appear here, we do have a form you can fill out. There is a pinned post on our Facebook. And if you go to our Instagram and under the bio, you'll see a Beacons page. Click that. At the very top is the submission form. You guys have been using it, and we thank you guys for that. As always, please visit guardiancme.com. That's where you can go get that is where you go to get free continuing education, not like paywall free, but like really free. It's all free. And I believe NREMT now allows you to get all of your continuing education credits online, if I'm not mistaken. So you can go there and knock out a whole ton. I know if you're in Oregon right now, June is fastly approaching and many of us have to research. So that's a good place to go right now. It's guardiancme.com. Our content's on there, their content's on there. Check out the Back to Basics podcast as well. If you guys want to hear more of, Chris and Jason, they're on there. And anything else?
Nicer, I'm way nicer on that podcast.
Yeah, he's way nicer on that one. Yeah.
All hate mail for Dr. Seitz can go to ems2020@gmail.com.
Actually, it can, because it's not quite correct for the email. So send it away.
Even better. Send it there.
Absolutely. And check out our YouTube channel, Rapid Sequence Information. We've got the, we talked about Damar Hamlin on there. We've got some other stuff there. So go check it out. And with that, bye.
Stay sweet.
All right.
Bye.
Hey guys, thanks so much for taking a listen. If you are studying for the National Registry exam, we're here to help. We have a National Registry prep program to help you pass that exam. Check us out at guardiantestprep.com. If you'd like continuing education credits for listening to our podcast or watching this on YouTube, follow us at guardiancme.com. 100% free CAPSE credits. No matter what state or country you're in, we're here to help. So again, we thank you so much for listening. We hope you have a wonderful week.